Hi, my name is Jackie. I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when I was 8. I play hard because that's how I do everything. I always push myself to be the best that I can be. Type 1 diabetes does not stop me from doing the things that I like to do.
Hello and welcome to Teen 1D, the podcast for teenagers and young adults living with type 1 diabetes. The podcast is not intended as a substitute for professional medicine advice or treatment. My guest for today is Michael Alter. Michael is a clinical professor of entrepreneurship at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
The majority of my listeners are teenagers and young adults with type 1 diabetes. So I would like to discuss your experiences with type 1 diabetes and your personal experience with entrepreneurship and business. How old were you when you were diagnosed with type 1 diabetes?
I was 23, I believe, 22, 23. So just out of college in my first job.
So was it challenging for you to learn how to control your blood sugars and all of the other tasks that come with having type 1 at this age?
It was probably no different than most of the other listeners that have type 1, right? It's never easy when you first get diagnosed. I had the advantage that I was sort of past my teen years and, you know, sort of through college. So there were some advantages of that. Some of the other challenges were, you know, I was in the working world. And so I sort of had to figure out how to balance that. You know, and again, you can tell from all the gray hair I have, this was before CGMs and a lot of the technology that exists today. You used to have to, you know, you pricked your finger. At least we had blood glucose monitors, you know, to check, but you'd prick your finger, put blood on a drop, there was a 60-second timer, and you'd wipe the blood off, stick it in the machine, and that's how you'd figure out what your blood sugar was. So it was a little more complicated than it is today.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. What do you do now?
So today I have a series of things. So I have most of the technology. I have a CGM. I have a Dexcom CGM. I use the Loop app. I don't know if you're familiar with the Loop app.
No, I've not heard of that before.
I have the Omnipod. My Omnipod is right here. And then I have this little orange device here that looks like an earbuds case, but it's actually a translator that translates the near field wireless on the my Omnipod to my iPhone.
Okay.
And then I have an app on my iPhone, which is off-label, FDA unapproved, but you can download and put on your phone, that basically controls my blood sugar. And so the CGM, the Dexcom feeds the app, and then that app talks to my pump, and it's an artificial pancreas type device where it gives me more or less insulin depending on how my sugars are.
Yes, I've had some guests on here previously who've talked about the closed loop system, mm-hmm. but I truly did not know what it looked like with the orange mm-hmm. case and that.
Well, and there's a series of different closed loop systems through pumps that are approved, and they're sort of approved through FDA channels. Tandem has one. Omnipod has one that's coming out soon. I don't know how familiar you are with the Omnipod pump, but that's the one
yes.
that has the tubes.
Currently use the Omnipod right now.
And do you use Dexcom?
Yes.
So you can get on the Loop for free. All you have to do is buy one of these.
Yes. And otherwise, that sounds great.
You have to go online. So you need a Mac somewhere in the house, or someone okay. has a Mac to download it once. And then you put it on your phone, and it's absolutely game changing. I wake up, you know, I don't have perfect sugars, but I wake up every day in range. Because overnight,
wow.
it brings you back in range. It's just so much better than anything before. Highly recommend them.
Yes, I definitely am thinking about it. From all of the stories I've heard with those who have used the closed loop system, all I hear is fantastic things.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And the Omnipod's own version that'll all be FDA approved is you know, pretty much supposedly, you know, this quarter, next quarter is supposed to get approval.
Yes, I really do hope that is coming as well.
Good. So those are most of what I do. And then I also, I guess that would be the main technology that I use.
So where did you go to college and what was your major?
So I went to Northwestern in the Chicago area, and I was an econ major at college.
So after graduating Northwestern, what was your next step?
So I went to work for IBM in their sales. At the time, they had a sales training program. So I went to sell for IBM.
And did you know that you'd wanted to do something like that right out of college?
To sell for IBM? No.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, I thought I would actually go and do something different out of college. I wanted to be in the business world, but I thought I would go be a consultant. And I interviewed with IBM because it seemed interesting and I didn't have a job yet and really sort of liked the opportunity and had a very good sort of family friend mentor that when I got the opportunity to go work for IBM versus my other options sort of basically said, learning to sell is a critical skill. It'll help you in everything in life, your whole life. So you'd be crazy not to take this job.
Yes. And we'll come back to that. I've read about the class that you teach now, and I just find the whole concept fascinating. How many years did you work for IBM before going back to get your MBA?
About 3 years.
And then where did you get your MBA?
I got my MBA at the Harvard Business School.
As someone who may be interested in MBA, what did you find most beneficial about your MBA coursework?
So, you know, the one thing I have to caveat is I got my MBA, I graduated in 1994. So it's been a number of years. And so some things are different, but I do teach an MBA program. So I get some sense of what's similar. The biggest value to me of getting my MBA was really sort of learning how to think and ask the right questions and having the confidence to believe you knew what the right questions were to ask when you're in a situation where you don't know what's going on, right? In business and in situations, you're often put in situations where you have to make decisions and you have very limited data. And, or maybe you have too much data and you got to figure out which data actually matters. Lots of, you know, data points. And so getting my MBA really taught me through so much case studies and stuff like that, sort of how to look at a situation, figure out what kind of questions to ask and have the confidence that I could ask the right ones and sort of follow ons from those pieces. As opposed to there was all sorts of theory that was, you know, game changing for my life. I just, you know, I think some of the concept I learned in 1994 are probably true, but most of it is ancient because the world has changed. But the sort of power to think and analyze has not. And that's been a core foundation for me.
After obtaining your MBA, what was the next step for you?
So I went into consulting. I worked for a company called McKinsey out of graduate school. Like to say, I made charts for a living for a while, but it was a great opportunity. And I spent almost 6 years at McKinsey. I was in their Boston office, in Chicago, and in London.
And then I read that you were the co-founder of SurePayroll. How did you decide that SurePayroll was the business that you wanted to create?
So I was a co-founder, but I was not the original founder. So it wasn't my idea to start it or create it, if you will. I got introduced to the three other folks that were, you know, sort of starting SurePayroll to join them. And so there were four of us that were sort of the founding team to start it. And, you know, for me, what I really liked about it, again, it's kind of situational to the time period, but this was when the internet first was starting. So this is back in 2000. And there were a lot of businesses out there that were going to be on the internet. Everybody that had an internet business, you named it with .com in the name because that made you better. And, you know, everybody's going to be a billionaire in 6 months. And it seemed a bit like an artificial bubble, but you never knew. And so many people were, you know, doing so well, and so much of the market was crazy, even if the businesses weren't any good. And I was at McKinsey, you know, sort of on the partner track, and I had decided in the late 90s that I, while McKinsey is a great place and I love the firm, I just didn't love the work enough to want to sort of commit and make the trade-offs that you make in any career, in any job. You know, you just work hard and a lot of travel and all those things. And for me, that work wasn't worth that trade-off. Not that there's anything wrong with it. And I wanted to do something else where I'd still work hard. I mean, as an entrepreneur, I work my ass off, but just it was different work for me. And so I decided to leave McKinsey, and I was looking around to kind of figure out what I wanted to do next. You know, do I want to go for a big company? Do I want to do a startup? Do I want to go to a growth stage business? And sort of coalesced around, I wanted to build something where I could really be involved in making it happen from nothing. And so I was introduced to these three folks that had the idea for SurePayroll. And I joined in terms of my role was to get customers. One of my partners, his role was to build the operations and technology, and was our first president. And it was a bit crazy jumping off a cliff, if you will, from a big corporate job with all the resources and staff, and you never had a make your you just had a lot of support, and you know, to go into a business where you've got nothing and you got to figure out everything from scratch was a bit of a shock for those first couple of months, for sure, I would say. But what I really loved about the business was it was a great market, which I think is really important. There was a real opportunity. The sort of economics of the business, could you make money? You know, are you selling a dollar for more than a dollar? You know, you're selling a dollar for $1.50, you make 50 cents. That's pretty good. A lot of the internet businesses were selling a dollar for 95 cents. And you just, you know, you can't make it up in volume when you're losing 5 cents every time you do something. And so I really thought this had solid economics. It was a huge market, which meant if we weren't that great and we only had 2 or 3% of the market, we were still a big business and valuable. And then third, and probably maybe as important, is that the other three founders really are very, very smart, thoughtful, good, ethical, honest people. And so I really felt like I was joining a team and that we were going to win together. And it turned out that way.
Perfect. And can you just tell us the background behind SurePayroll, just in terms of what it did as a company?
So it provides payroll outsourcing services to small businesses in the U.S. So as anybody who employs somebody in the United States, the federal government makes you as the employer the unpaid tax collector for them. And so when you pay an employee, you have to withhold a certain amount of the salary you pay them for taxes and pay it to the government. And then that individual employee, when they get to the end of the year as an individual citizen, they file their tax returns, but they don't have to pay all the money in already because the government's already got a bunch of it. And so what this means in simple terms is, as an employer, you've got this task that's a pain in the ass, which is to manage all the taxes for your employees, but you get no benefit from it. There's no advantage because you do your payroll better than the next person. It's just a pain in the ass. And so there are people that do it themselves. There are people that use software to do it. And then there are people that use firms that manage it for you and take away the headache. And so we were trying to be one of those outsource firms to take away that headache. And at the time, most of the competitors in the space were doing it sort of pre-internet. So they were using phones and fax machines to call in the payroll information, to physically print and deliver checks. And we thought we could leverage the power of the internet to do it cheaper, better, faster, by making it all electronic. And that's what we ended up doing.
That's such a great concept. You've been the executive chairman or CEO for several companies. You have also been on the board or advisory board for many companies as well. Is there anything that you've learned from all of these positions that you wish you would have known earlier?
I'm learning every day still. And what I'm learning is I'm not really that... I got a lot to learn, let me put it that way.
Me too.
In terms of what I'm learning. You know, there's lots of different things. You know, there's business lessons, there's personal lessons. You know, it's really important that you end up working with people that you value and trust. And I've been fortunate to do that, because you're going to spend a lot of time with folks. You want to make sure that there's, you know, trust and honesty in how you work with folks. I think it is a lot. You know, this may sound obvious, but I would much rather be in a good, big, growing market than anything. And so I can have the best team in the world, but if we're in a tough space, it's really hard anyway. It's really hard, you know. So if I am a buggy whip manufacturer at the turn of the 19th century, that's a tough business to sustain because the car's coming, right? Whereas if I was a car manufacturer in the 1900s, there's a lot of cars to be built. And so there's a much bigger opportunity. And so sometimes just being in a space where there's huge room to grow is a great opportunity. And it's just easier. You know, those are some of the things that I would say I've learned. And the last thing I've learned is that, you know, you should, in business, pace really matters and cadence. And so why do tomorrow what you can do today?
Can you tell us about the class that you teach at University of Chicago's Booth School of Business?
Sure. So I'm involved in two things at the university. I'm part of the faculty for the New Venture Challenge, which is our business competition. And I am I'm a faculty coach. And then the class that I teach is called Entrepreneurial Selling. And it's the only sales class in the business school. And it's really designed to help entrepreneurs figure out how to get their business off the ground and how to get it started. If you think about a lot of the MBA programs, and Booth is not alone in that, they do a really good job of helping students understand how a business operates, the strategy, the finance, managing the cash. how, you know, as a business gets larger, there's more scope and complexity and you need strategy and organizational changes and things like that. And at a place like Booth and some of the other schools where they have entrepreneurship programs, they also do a really good job of teaching people how to think about a business, how to understand what they call the business model canvas. Is this business going to be profitable? How might it work? What's unique about it? You know, what's the problem we're solving? And so there's some strategy classes and some finance classes. But there's, in the end, we teach students how to make these great PowerPoints and how to go out and raise money. And they raise a bunch of money to build their business. And then we teach them how to grow it once it's up and running at a larger scale. And, you know, then we teach them how to be rich. But we don't actually teach them the tough job of going from zero revenue to actually getting some customers. And how do you create a replicable, scalable process where you know how to get the first customer, the second customer, and then how do you get customers 10, 20, 50, et cetera. And so my class is all geared on that sort of zero to scaling revenue piece. And it's really designed to help somebody think about how do they do that. And it's much broader than just sort of a traditional sales role, because as an entrepreneur, you're creating something often out of nothing. You're selling in what I'll call 360 degrees, because not only do I have to sell a customer to buy my product, but I might have to sell someone to invest in my business. I might have to sell a supplier to route their, you know, sell me their product versus somebody else. I have to convince people to come work for me, often coming from good jobs where they're paid well, not working as hard as they're going to work for the entrepreneur, and with no risk, to come work for less money, more risk, and more hours. That's a sales challenge, right? And so that's what this class is really designed to help people think through. And so it's much broader than just, hey, how do we, you know, sort of rinse and repeat what we've been doing for 100 years?
Yes. And then while preparing for this interview, I read that about one of your classes and about how selling yourself both in life and in business is a skill. And I just thought that was such an interesting concept as well. Would you expand on that a little bit for us?
Sure. I mean, I think we're all selling all the time. You know, it's interesting. I ask my students at every class, I have them before the first class, they fill out this Google form and ask them a series of questions. And one of the questions is, when are you selling? When do you find yourself selling? And it's a free word answer. And then I put it into a word cloud. And, you know, you'd expect it to come out, well, if I'm in sales or if I'm selling to customers, right? But when you look at the word cloud, it says basically all the time, everything. I'm selling at work. I'm selling at home. I'm selling when I go on a date. I'm selling when I, you know, when I go to the store, I'm always selling. And if you think about what sales really is, it's just another word for persuasion. And we're all persuading in some way or another people to listen and to be influenced by us in something. And so I think the skills and the things that are taught in sales both certainly help in the business world to drive revenues, but they're just helpful in life.
And so as for the students in your classes, what age range do they typically fall in, if there is one? And what types of careers did they have before enrolling in the Booth School of Business or afterwards? Mm-hmm.
So I teach in, there are four programs in the school, and I've taught in all four at different times. So there's the full-time program, which is, it's a two-year program, the summer off, where students are coming in and, you know, that's their full-time gig. And they're oftentimes changing careers, if you will. And those students, I think the average age is around 28, I could find out, but they've been working on average sort of 4 to 6 years in the working world. And they've done a variety of things. They've worked for larger companies. They've worked in consulting. They've worked in investment banking, other finance roles. They may have worked in a sales role or manufacturing operations role, but they've been, some of them even been entrepreneurs. And they decide to take 2 years out to sort of build their skill set and their toolkit, and oftentimes, again, shift industries. You know, I was in finance, I want to be in marketing, or I was in consulting, I want to be in investment banking. And then I teach in the evening and weekend programs, which are two different programs. And here you tend to have students who are a little bit older on average, who've been working a bit longer, and they have a full-time job. And so they're doing this over and above their full-time job to either get more skills that'll help them be more successful in their career with that current employer, or give them the foundation to continue to grow and develop, you know, in the future with that employer or with another employer. And then lastly, there's the executive program, which is taught in, there's students that come from Europe, from Asia, and from the US. And depending on where you are, like in the US, it's every other Friday and Saturday for 2 years. And those students tend to be sponsored by their employer. They tend to give in time off to do this program by their employer. And they tend to be even older and more senior in their careers.
Do you think that everyone would benefit by taking a course in entrepreneurship because of the art of selling involved in these careers?
I think everyone would benefit from taking an entrepreneurship class, regardless of selling or not. Yes, absolutely. Because, you know, entrepreneurs and entrepreneurship is about building things. It's about getting stuff done and executing. And it's about dealing with ambiguity and uncertainty and trying to put some certainty and results around it. And if you think about life, those are three important life skills.
Yes. And to continue on with that, do you think that some people are natural sellers, or is it a skill that someone must acquire?
Yeah, Jackie, that's a great question. And there's all sorts of debate around that. And I actually have a pretty strong point of view of it. And I've seen some research to sort of support what I'm about to say. But the belief that a lot of people have is that you're born as a salesperson. And the reason they believe that is because it's the person who's the life of the party, who's the one that can go out to dinner and everybody loves that person and they're back slapping and they're the person that everybody always wants to go have fun with. And those are your best salespeople. And the reality is that's just not true. Sales is very situational. And for the most part, anybody can learn to be a very good salesperson if they do it their way and their style, as opposed to trying to copy and be something they're not. And if you think about what the research has shown is if you think about people can be, in one dimension, they can be extremely extroverted, which is they get their energy. They like to be with people. They're talking out in the world, if you will. And then the other end of the spectrum, there's people that are introverted, which they tend to get their energy more quietly, they need some quiet time to read and to think. Not that one is right or wrong. Those are different personality styles. But the research will show is unless you're at either end of the spectrum, so the top 5% most extroverted or the top 5% most introverted, the 90% in the middle, they can learn to sell as long as they do it their way. And sales is really about gaining trust, and you do that by listening and trying to solve problems. It's not the used car salesperson trying to push, tell me what your price range is, I'll buy that. That's never going to work, really. That's transactional. And so these other skills we all have, we just have to do it our way.
You talked about just the art of listening to what others around you have to say. In these business courses, do you ever have to do a group project like this? Do you find that people sell better together in groups or separately when they're on their own?
Two slightly different questions. We do, for my course, I do have a group project, which is the final, which runs the whole gamut of the class. And then it culminates in a mock sales event. And so there is work, and they do work in teams of three, and we pair them with real live entrepreneurs to help those entrepreneurs build a sales toolkit for their business. And so at the end of every quarter, these entrepreneurs get this sales toolkit that they can use in their business to get their first couple of customers or help their first salesperson get up to speed. Yes, we have that, if you will, from that piece. The second question is sort of like selling in groups or selling individually, which is better. And for the most part, when you sell in a group, just like you do most things in a group, it's better, but it's harder. If you've got three minds on a problem, you're likely to get to a better answer. Somebody might hear something that somebody else doesn't. Somebody might respond or ask a question different than somebody else. And that's what gets you to a better answer. But it's harder because when there's three people in the room selling, how do you coordinate and control what the other two people are saying? And how do you keep it smooth and not talk over each other? How do you make sure that you flow the conversation so you're not going from one topic to the other? How does that all work easily? Whereas if you're the only person in the room, it's easier because you hopefully get to control what you say and what you don't say. And so therefore, it's easier to do a one-person sales call, but oftentimes the results are better when you have multiple.
Okay. That's just such an interesting concept.
Yeah. And I would say, and it's going to change and vary depending on what you're selling. Again, that's very situational. right? If you need to buy a car and you need it today, that's one type of sale versus if you're the government procurement officer who's going to buy the equipment for a nuclear power plant, right? Those are very, very different sales processes. And so it's very situational in terms of how you think about it, both in terms of the skills and the way you go to market.
So I know that you're involved with JDRF as well. Would you care to share how you became involved with them?
Sure. So I'll tell you today, I'm on the international board of JDRF, and I am the chairman of the funding committee, which is the money raising side. I have been involved in JDRF for about a decade. So if you're doing the math from the beginning of the conversation, if I was diagnosed in sort of 1990, and you know, I've only been involved for 10 years, I certainly was not involved for a number of years. And in some ways, I regret that a little bit. I was always, early in my career, I was afraid to tell people I was a diabetic type 1 because I didn't want them to think less of me. And I thought that that might impact my career and my ability to grow and develop professionally if people, you know, thought of me as different. And I would tell you that that's a load of crap. And that was just insecurity for me. And I've certainly gotten over that now. And now I tell everybody I'm a type 1. And if I see someone with a pump, I go up to them and say hello. And so I've changed on that front. And then the other thing that was really hard for me for a number of years was I didn't want to get involved because I didn't want to go raise money and ask my friends and family for money that would directly benefit me. I would rather help another charity and other people than me directly. And so I just said, you know, this isn't for me. And it's interesting. There's a there was a gentleman named Jim Tyree who was here in Chicago, and he's sort of a legend in Chicago philanthropy and a number of organizations. And he had been the chairman of JDRF overall. He'd been very involved in growing of JDRF, and he was a type 1 himself. And, you know, it's maybe a long story, but I was he was an investor through the firm that he ran in the company SurePayroll that I was running. And we were seated together randomly at an American Heart Association breakfast. And we were chatting, and he started asking me a bunch of questions about my business. And I wasn't sure that I wanted to tell him all those answers because I wasn't sure that my numbers were going to be good enough for him. So I decided, you know what? Why don't I change the subject? Maybe I can think of something else to talk to him about. And I knew that he was a type 1 and I was a type 1. And so I said, hey, you know, Jim, we have something else in common. We're both type 1s. And he turned to me and he said, oh, interesting, Michael. Funny, I've never seen you at any of the JDRF events. You're not involved. Why not? And I said, well, because I don't want to, I don't feel right about asking people for money that's something that's going to directly benefit me. So I'm happy to be here at the American Heart Association breakfast supporting my employees that have this challenge, but I'm not going to raise money for myself. And he basically turned to me in an extremely colorful language that you probably couldn't say on a podcast, said something to the effect of get over yourself. That's absolutely ridiculous. You have the ability to help raise money, to find a cure, and to change the trajectory for so many people today and in the future. It's not about you. It's about the bigger cause and the greater good of all these people that are impacted. So shame on you for not doing something. And, you know, I sort of taken back a little bit by the directness of it. I didn't know him that well, but he was absolutely right. And, you know, the next thing I knew, I'm in front of the executive director, Illinois. And then my wife and I were the Fund a Cure family at the gala. We were the gala chairs. And then I was the chapter president in Illinois, and I'm on the international board. And now I'm the chair of the funding committee on the international board. And,
wow.
I owe all of that to Jim Tyree, who unfortunately passed away, I think it was 2012, or so. And, just an unbelievable man, an unbelievable champion for our cause and so many. And he really taught me a huge lesson. And today, you know, they send me out to do the Jim Tyree talk. And, you know, I'll meet somebody who sort of was in my shoes, maybe 15 years younger than me, with the same issue, and I'll get them involved for those same reasons.
So to close things out, do you have any advice for teenagers or young adults interested in becoming entrepreneurs with type 1?
I mean, I think if you want to be an entrepreneur, you know, some of being an entrepreneur is just doing it, right? You can't, I think it was Tina Fey that said, you can't be the little kid who sits at the top of the slide all day waiting to go down, right? Entrepreneurs get stuff done. So you got to just go down the slide, and you know what? You might fail. And if you fail, it's not the end of the world. And, you know, the sooner you learn that failure is not the end of the world, the better off you are in life, I think. As an entrepreneur, there are multiple paths to entrepreneurship, and there's not any one path. And some of that has to do with what people's aspirations are. Right? Do you want to be the next Bill Gates and build, you know, be one of the richest people in the world? Or do you just want to control your destiny and not have a boss? Right? Those are very, very different things. Do you want to make your avocation, what you love to do, your job? And so you might have to create an entrepreneurial business to do that. And so some of it has to do with why do you want to do it? And then are you passionate about what you want to do? And then, you know, sort of after that, it's a little bit of how much risk do you want to take? You know, there are some people that will jump in with both feet and mortgage their credit cards. And, you know, we hear great stories about those few that are successful, and a whole bunch of them aren't as successful. There are others that work for 20 years in a business, and then they leave to start a business similar to the one they were in, where they kind of know and are much, you know, much more knowledgeable about it. There's different degrees of risk and different degrees of perspectives. You know, you can be an entrepreneur before you get a college degree. You can be an entrepreneur after you get a college degree. I would argue that if you're an entrepreneur with a college degree and it fails, you can go be employed as somebody with a college degree, and that's probably better than not, right? And so again, it's just sort of a degree of risk that you want to take. But I think you have to be comfortable with ambiguity. You have to be comfortable with failing, and you got to be comfortable where somebody's not going to tell you what to do. If I were to give advice to my younger self about being a type one, I would say is you can't feel sorry for yourself, right? We all are dealt a set of cards. Some of those cards are good. Some of those cards are bad. But what determines the person is how well you play the cards you're dealt, because you can't change the cards you're dealt. And what that means is it is what it is. It sucks, but there are people that have a lot worse things than we do as type ones. And so you got to figure out how you live with it, how you manage it. You can't be, you know, I've learned that perfection is not really the answer, because my sugars are not always going to be perfect, and I'll do everything right and they still won't be perfect. And you can't get mad at yourself. You just, you know, it is what it is. And some days are better than others. And that's actually a pretty good strategy in life. And so I think being a diabetic sort of gives you that advantage if you can sort of see it that way. I also don't believe that diabetes should slow you down and limit you from doing anything you want in the world. I don't think I could be a professional pitcher, you know, in baseball, but that's not because I'm a diabetic, because I can't throw a 90 mile an hour fastball, not let alone throw it straight. Right. That's just, you know, that's a different issue for me. Right. But if I wanted to do something because I was a type one and I had the sort of the skills, there's no reason you can't.
Thank you so much for agreeing to be here. And as my last question, I like to ask my guests if they have any recommendations for books, movies, or activities that they enjoy, because at the end of the day, we're all just people and more than our type one.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, you should hopefully find things that you enjoy and try lots of things that you like. You know, I think a book that is really simple and really quick read that is, you know, sort of along the lines of, you know, don't let things hold you back and figure out how to help others and how to be engaged. It's called Wait What? About 80 pages, and it's basically the book that came out of his commencement speech at the Harvard School of Education. He used to be the dean of Harvard School of Education, and he gave a speech of the four key questions everybody should be asking and a bonus question, and the book sort of talks through that, and it's great. Wait what?
Thank you so much. I'm now going to do this. Great.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for agreeing to be here.